In one of the most difficult times to be Jewish, he gave people of his faith hope. Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. In this hour, we're talking about Hank Greenberg, Hammer and Hank, one of the greatest baseball players of his era and this country's first Jewish superstar athlete. Joining us on the phone is John Rosengren, the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. It details Greenberg's rise to fame and struggles with anti-Semitism. John Rosengren, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be here.
Listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Share your stories about Hank Greenberg or baseball, maybe just stories about dealing with anti-Semitism. 614-292-8513. You can also email the show at allsides@wosu.org. You can tweet us at @WOSUAllSides. And you can find us on Facebook. John Rosengren, Hank Greenberg, a famous guy. His life story has been pretty well documented. Why write this book?
Well, because when I was researching, I found it hadn't been documented well enough. I got interested in the story by doing an article on a famous home run Greenberg hit to finish the 1945 season. He had come back from the military and hit a grand slam in the ninth inning on the final day of the season to clinch the pennant for the Tigers. And in researching that article, I realized there was a lot more to his life than just this single dramatic home run, that he'd become a cultural icon for Jews during a difficult time. And I looked around and I saw that he had put together a book himself when he was dying the summer of 1986. He sat by his pool and recorded a lot of his memories into a dictaphone. And then Ira Burko took those and kind of lovingly shaped them into a book. But the problem was twofold. One, the narrative was choppy, going back and forth between Greenberg and Burko. But then also his memory, you know, as any of us thinking back on events 40, 50, 60 years previous, He played tricks on him, and he got details wrong. And then there was also a good documentary, The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg, but it finished with Greenberg's playing days in 1947, and so there was a lot of story left to tell. And it, too, repeated some of the mistakes that had been in Greenberg's book. And so I wanted to set the record straight, and I wanted to tell the complete story of Hank Greenberg. And I also wanted to tell the story of who he was completely as a man, with his failings as well as his successes. And I just thought there was a place for that, and that he was an important figure in American history. His story needed to be told.
Mm-hmm. You did a great job, but let's set the table here with some background. Greenberg was born in New York, the son of Romanian immigrants. Tell us more about him.
Well, he grew up in the Bronx in a Jewish neighborhood and never really had to think about what it meant to be a Jew until he left home and was not surrounded by Jews anymore. And some of the places where he went, people had never met a Jew. And so they were curious to see what he was like. There's a story about a teammate coming up to him and walking around him on the field in the minor leagues. And Greenberg said, "What the hell are you gawking at?" And he said, "Well, I've just never seen a Jew before. I wondered what you look like." As though he was a freak in a carnival show. But it forced Greenberg to start thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be a Jew? And it became especially poignant for him when he wound up in Detroit in 1933 for his rookie year. And that was the city of Henry Ford, who was the arch anti-Semite of America, and also Reverend Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest in suburban Detroit, who had a radio show where he'd spew rhetoric about Jews being out to topple Christianity and subvert capitalism. So he faced this anti-Semitism and had to, you know, think, what does it mean to be a Jew, and what's my responsibility? He wanted to just be a ball player, the son of Romanian immigrants. He just wanted to assimilate playing America's game. But he realized that people looked to him as a Jew, and in two ways. One, there was the anti-Semitism, and so he had kind of natural enemies wherever he went. And he had to rise above that. But at the same time, he also had a natural fan base wherever he went. I mean, the Jews in Detroit embraced him. And then whatever city he played in, Chicago, Detroit, or St. Louis, New York, there was a fan base there willing to cheer against their home team to cheer for Greenberg because he was one of theirs. And his success became their success. And as a result, he realized that he had a responsibility to the Jewish people.
We're talking with John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Just how religious was Hank Greenberg? He had some highly publicized struggles over whether to play on the High Holy Days, which I want to delve into more later in this conversation. But how important was his faith to him?
He was raised in an Orthodox household, and I think as a teenager, like many teenagers, he didn't take his faith real seriously. But as a young man, when he left home, He was more observant than I think many people give him credit for, and he sought out in the minor leagues a boarding house where he could celebrate the Seder meal at Passover. He would go to Shul on his own, you know, and celebrate the holy days. And so I think his religion was important to him as a young man in his 20s. When he served in the Second World War, he became disillusioned with religion and kind of abandoned his observant practices, but he remained immensely proud of being a Jew. You know, his ethnicity was forever important to him.
He was definitely the first Jewish superstar, I would say. But were there any popular Jewish athletes before him?
There were other athletes, certainly other baseball players. Andy Cohen comes to mind. He played for the Giants, was briefly a star. There was a Glickman, I can't remember his first name, who was a track and field athlete who was denied in the 36 Olympics, wasn't able to represent the United States. Marty Glickman, I think it is. There were other boxers. Max Baer was one. But Greenberg played America's game. You know, the baseball truly was the national pastime back then. And so he rose to the the top as he had the biggest platform, which is performing.
You're right that Greenberg wasn't just a hero, but also a social pioneer in an era before Jackie Robinson, even before the formation of Israel, a baseball player who became a really powerful symbol against anti-Semitism. And again, this is in the unique backdrop of Detroit that this is all going on.
Right, and there were several other factors there. You mentioned the significance of the fact that there wasn't the state of Israel. And so, you know, the Jews didn't have this rallying point of Israel at the time, and they were looking for something to rally around. And one of the reasons they were, or several of the reasons they were, was it was a time of intense ethnic identification because there was this large wave of immigration to the United States in the early 20th century. And so people identified strongly with their own, whether it be, you know, Polish or German or Italian or Jewish. And people grew up, you know, in neighborhoods where they spoke that language of the home country. And Hank grew up speaking Yiddish at his home and in his neighborhood. So there's a strong ethnic identification, much stronger than we have today. And then there's also the intense anti-Semitism at the time, and not just in Europe where Hitler's ramping up his war machine, but also in the United States where their quotas at universities. Greenberg had gotten a scholarship to Princeton but was denied admission because they'd fulfilled their 2% quota of Jews in the student body. Jewish doctors couldn't practice at the hospitals or in certain law firms, or there were restricted communities where Jews were not allowed to live. There are signs, no dogs, no Jews. I mean, this was pervasive in American society, and so Jews were looking for a hero, rallying point, and here comes Greenberg, 6'4", 220, smashing stereotypes every time he steps on the field, as well as slugging home runs. He becomes this hero, and as a result, a cultural icon for the Jewish people and the standard bearer of his generation.
Just how much anti-Semitism did he face at the ballpark?
It was incredible. You know, people are pretty familiar with Jackie Robinson as the first African-American player in the major leagues and how much abuse he faced. Greenberg's teammate Bertie Tebbutt said, other than Jackie Robinson, no one suffered more abuse than Hank Greenberg. And it came from everywhere. It came from people in the stands. You know, even in Detroit, when he was playing at home, you know, the bigots were out there yelling at him. Other teams were giving him a hard time. The practice of bench jockeying was much more pervasive. If people seen the movie 42, they see an example of Ben Chapman, the Phillies manager, yelling at Greenberg. Now, it didn't happen like that. The guy wouldn't stand out in front of the dugout. They're more cowardly, and they'd sit on the bench, so you couldn't tell who was yelling. But it was a lot of people on the bench yelling nasty stuff, and that was part of the psychological warfare of the time. But even from his own teammates, he was abused. And, you know, if he made a mistake or if he struck out, he said, you know, I'm not just a bum, I'm a Jewish bum. And on his team, if he made a mistake, sometimes people would, you know, say, you Jewish bastard, or you Jewish son of a bitch, why'd you miss that? And so it wasn't just an insult, but it was an ethnic slur. And as a result, he stood up to much of that and ended up getting in fights with a couple teammates as well as opponents to defend himself.
I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're joined by John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, share your stories of Hank Greenberg as well. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can email allsides at WOSU.org. And we are joined by Jerry on the Northwest Side. Jerry, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Oh, I got so many stories. I was pulling for Hank to hit 60 or 61 home runs in 38. He ended up with 58. I saw him play in 46, and I saw him again in 83 when they had G-Man days, Hank Greenberg and Charlie Gerringer, and he had 183 ribbies, RBIs, 1 year. I forget what year. I've got it in a book on the Tigers. But anyway, he was fantastic, and they'd have driven a Brinks truck up to see him today, to pay him. In fact, I don't know what he made. But I got to say this, and maybe it's in the book by Mr. Rosengrantz. In 1940, 73 years ago, Spike Briggs, who was the owner of the Detroit Tigers, paid Hank Greenberg, who was playing first base, a $10,000 bonus to go to the outfield so Rudy York, who was the catcher, could go to first base. Did you have that in your book, Mr. Rosengrantz?
I did. And first off, I'm glad you brought up the RBIs because that's such an astounding statistic. And it was 183 in 1937.
Yeah, that's it.
And it was actually in 1940. Yeah, Greenberg was playing first, and then they couldn't find a spot for Rudy York because he was such a lousy fielder. And John Lardner said that he would be out there in the outfield trying to guess where the ball would go, but the ball often outwitted him. Jack Zeller who was the general manager, and he called Hank in before the season and said, "Hey, we need you to play left field." And Hank said, "No way." He said, I'm not going to do it. Because he feared he'd look bad, and he said, "I'm going to go talk to Mr. Briggs." And Zeller said, "Nope, Briggs is behind me on this one." And Hank got very upset, and he came back and he demanded $10,000 if he would be in the starting lineup on opening day. And so throughout his career, Greenberg worked very hard, and he worked real hard to learn how to play left field. And he was not an outstanding fielder, but he became a decent left fielder. Sure enough, he was in the lineup on opening day. He got his $10,000. And I might also mention he became the MVP in 1940, or he won the MVP award in 1940, the first guy to do it at two different positions. He'd won it in 35 and again in 40.
He was a great tennis player, too. Did you know that?
Yeah, matter of fact, he'd win these celebrity tennis tournaments beating guys half his age like O.J. Simpson and Julius Erving, Stone.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry, thanks so much for the call.
Oh, I appreciate it. I got to get that book, read it, and send it to my 88-year-old brother.
Thanks again, Jerry. Thanks again,
Have
Jerry.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call.
Greenberg was also a notoriously bad fielder at first base when he first came into the league, and he worked very hard to get better at that. When you say Hank Greenberg, he's very, very well known, obviously, in baseball circles. But if I did an office poll, I bet a lot of people would not know him. They know Babe Ruth, they know Lou Gehrig, Ted Williams, similar players of the area. Why isn't Hank Greenberg quite as well known?
You know, it's a question that's baffled me because he was as good as those guys.
Right.
Greenberg was... he and Babe Ruth alone, in all the guys who ever played Major League Baseball, only Hank Greenberg and Babe Ruth have had 96 or more extra bases in four seasons. I mean, that's astounding. He and Ruth stand alone. Hank Greenberg and Lou Gehrig hold the record for most RBIs per game, the average of most RBIs per game, which is .92. So almost an RBI per game. And it's just, Sam Thompson is in there too. So three guys, tops in the league. But I think he's not as well known because he played in Detroit, but it wasn't New York. And if he were, he was very, very well known. I mean, he was the most prominent athlete in America in the spring of 1941 when he was inducted. But I think with time, some of the other players have been remembered better because, the Yankees have preserved the legacy of Greenberg and Ruth, and the fan base is larger there. And Hank, unfortunately, just hasn't maintained his place at the level which he deserves.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a break here. Then we're going to get more into the life and career of Hank Greenberg. We're talking with John Rosengren, the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, give us a call, 614-292-8513, 292-8513. We will be right back. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today, and we're talking about Hammer and Hank Greenberg. We're speaking with John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, share your stories about Hank Greenberg or possibly dealing with anti-Semitism, a major issue in Greenberg's life and career. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, 614-292-8513. We are joined by Jerome from Marysville. Jerome, good morning.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What I wanted to say is, I mean, certainly America has been a great home to Jews, but I think anti-Semitism is underappreciated in our day and takes very subtle forms. For example, the Office of Civil Rights in the U.S. Department of Education will not touch religious issues. What ethnic group out there is defined as anything but the religion, the Jews. My children have been treated terribly at the schools, and the Department of Education says they're bound legally not to deal with it. Any other minority group, they'd be on it. And also, I mean, just think about the discussion today. Everything seems to be about the past. And the couple weeks ago,
We appear to have lost.
No, I'm here. I'm back.
Oh, John's back.
Yes.
John, we appear to have lost our other caller who was calling about how anti-Semitism seems to be overlooked in today's day and age.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm not Jewish. And so for me, it was a real education to research the anti-Semitism in the 30s and 40s. And I had no idea that there was such rampant anti-Semitism here in the United States, you know, where newspapers would, in their advertisements, say Gentiles only, or the neighborhood next to me, I'm in Minneapolis, and the neighborhood next door, Edina, was a restricted community, you know, no Jews allowed. And it was a real eye-opener for me as a Gentile to learn about this in our history. And I think, you know, if we're not a part of a minority or a group that's being discriminated against or that has prejudice against, we're often not as aware of it. And so that's why I think it's so important for you know, someone like me to learn about this. You know, I don't know what it's like to be a woman in America. I don't know what it's like to be an African American in America. I didn't know what it was like to be a Jew in America. But I think in doing the research, I have a much better idea that it was not an easy thing. And people tell me, you know, as I do these or as I talk around the country and such, that the anti-Semitism remains, that it's not as socially acceptable today, but it still is present.
Greenberg turned down the Yankees at the age of 18 to attend college. He eventually signed with the Tigers. I want to reiterate that a baseball player who grew up in New York turned down the Yankees at the height of Babe Ruth's power. I still can't believe that. How on earth did he turn down the Yankees?
Well, and when you think about it, he would have been a great gate attraction. John McGraw was quite public, the manager of the Giants, New York Giants at the time, saying what a great gate attraction a Jewish star would be because of the large Jewish fan base in New York. And so he actively was seeking out Jewish players. But when Hank Greenberg's father asked McGraw for a tryout for his son, McGraw said, "Nah, we've seen him play in high school. He's no good. He'll never make it as a ball player." Well, of course, Hank wound up in the Hall of Fame. So McGraw wasn't as astute a judge of talent as you might think. But the Yankees were very actively pursuing Greenberg. It was even Paul Critchell, who was the same scout who landed Lou Gehrig, who was trying to sign Hank. And he took Hank to a game, and Hank, while Babe Ruth was at bat, Hank was distracted by the guy in the on-deck circle, the cleanup hitter, Lou Gehrig. Gehrig had huge thighs, enormous shoulders and chest, you know, great power. And Greenberg said, "I don't think I can beat out that guy." And Critchell said, "Oh, he's washed up." And Greenberg said, "Nah, he looks like he has a few good years left in him to me." Of course, he had nine before he missed a game at first base. And so the Yankees had made a generous offer, but Greenberg wisely, even for a 19-year-old, knew he wasn't going to be able to budge Gehrig off first base. So the Tigers were offering him money and the chance to go to college, which is what Greenberg's parents really wanted for their son. So he took the Tigers' offer and wound up in Detroit.
So he turns down the Yankees to go to college, eventually signs with Detroit, which doesn't have a very large Jewish population, at least not anywhere in New York. And then things got harder for Greenberg from there. Talk about his early days in Detroit, both on the field and dealing with the anti-Semitism.
There was a man named Harold Allen who read about Greenberg signing with the Tigers, and he thought, uh-oh, that young man is going to be lonely here in town. There were only 75,000 Jews in a population of about 2 million in the Detroit metro area. So he befriended Greenberg, and the Jewish community embraced him, and he would have dinners at people's houses. You know, they'd invite him to dinner, and he'd go. I mean, much different situation than today. Can you imagine Derek Jeter, you know, accepting a dinner invitation to come go have dinner at someone's house? Anyway, he was embraced by the Jewish community, and at the same time, there were the bigots who were giving him a hard time, and when he struck out, he was not just a bum, he was a Jewish bum. But he then his Jewishness really rose to prominence in his second season, 1934, when the Tigers were in a pennant race against the Yankees, and he made the comment that he might not play on the High Holy Days, which fell in September, and people were all up in arms over that in Detroit, saying, wait a minute, the High Holy Days come every year, but we haven't won a pennant in Detroit in 25 years. What do you mean? Well, many people didn't realize the significance of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and how in the Jewish tradition, those are the two holiest days, and one isn't supposed to work or play on those days. One goes to synagogue and prays. And yet Detroit was in the midst of the Depression. It hit the city very hard. Unemployment in 34 was 40%. And so baseball had given the town a diversion, and the Tigers' success had given them a reason to feel good about their city and a sense of civic pride. And Greenberg was leading the team, and so the thought of him sitting out a game infuriated people and concerned them. And he felt this real dilemma between his civic duty to play for the team and also this promise he'd made to his parents not to play on the High Holy Days and observe his faith. And he went to synagogue that morning. He was very conflicted. Finally decided he owed it to his teammates to play. So he plays on Rosh Hashanah, hits two home runs. The Tigers win 2-1. And he, everybody, you know, lauds him as a hero. And then he also decides 9 days later, it was rather convenient, the Tigers had a bigger lead over the Yankees, pretty much clinched the pennant, and so he sat out and didn't play. So he sort of struck this compromise on how to observe his faith and also to be a good teammate. But it raised his level of prominence in the United States because it just drew national attention, and he discovered just how important his Jewishness was, not only to him, but to others who looked to him as a representative of the Jews.
I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, give us a call. Share your stories of Hank Greenberg, 614-292-8513. 614-292-8513. You can also tweet the show at WOSU All Sides. You can find us on Facebook, and you can send emails to allsides@wosu.org. So you have Hank Greenberg coming up, coming into his own as a great slugger of his era. He's in Detroit, and you mentioned earlier that Detroit is also home to the most prominent anti-Semite of the time, Henry Ford. How does that conflict play out? What's that like?
Well, when you consider who Henry Ford was to Detroit, I mean, he's a paterfamilias of the city, of the Motor City. And in the 20s, he was writing these screeds in his publication, The Dearborn Independent, against Jews in Hollywood and the movies and jazz music in baseball. There's one headline, The Peril of Baseball, Too Much Jew. And he blamed all the problems in baseball on Jews and being hooligans and the fans to gamblers fixing games. So, you know, this is the environment and Hank steps into. And because many people hadn't met a Jew, they were willing to believe whatever anyone would tell them about Jews and what Jews were like. And so there were many, many people with these negative images and sort of unexamined prejudices thinking about Greenberg. And you know, as I said earlier, when he struck out, he wasn't just a bum, he was a Jewish bum, which meant that he was fulfilling sort of these prophecies or prejudices that people had put forth. And so he, just by his success, eradicated a lot of that ignorance. And people realized, hey, these guys aren't bad guys. And he was a pillar in the community. He was a smart, intelligent guy. And good-looking and charming. And so he won over a lot of people simply by being who he was and giving people a chance to meet a Jew and realize, hey, these aren't like what we've been told.
Mm-hmm. Chad is calling from Upper Arlington. Chad, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I was a senior in high school in eastern Pennsylvania, a Detroit Tiger fan. And then I read in the newspaper that Hank Greenberg said he would, and I'm a Methodist, and said he would not play baseball on a Jewish holy day. I was very impressed with this, and I was required by an English teacher to write a poem. So I wrote a poem, and I still have it, but I can't find it. I wrote a poem on how impressive it was for this Jewish professional ball player not to play on a Jewish holiday.
Mm-hmm. John Rosengren, is that a typical story where a lot of non-Jewish people impressed by Greenberg's decision?
Well, I think Greenberg won over a lot of respect, and when you consider it, I mean, Gentile or Christians were playing on Easter, they were playing on Good Friday, you know, playing on Christmas, not baseball, but other sports. And so here comes a guy who says, I'm going to stay true to my faith. And another guy, Edgar Guest, who was the people's poet of the day, wrote a poem that the Detroit Free Press published and then got circulated widely around the country about Hank's decision not to play on Yom Kippur. And it ends with, we shall miss him on the infield and shall miss him at the bat, but he's true to his religion, and I honor him for that. And it's in the voice of two Irish guys speaking about him. And so, yeah, I think he won over a lot of respect of people from Chad to Edgar Guest.
Well, Chad, thanks for your call. You wrote that there were some misconceptions or even mistruths about Greenberg's struggles on whether or not to play on the high holy days. What were those?
Well, perhaps the most commonly circulated story is that Greenberg consulted a rabbi prior to making his decision. It's true that rabbis were giving him plenty of unsolicited advice on what to do. He was getting telegrams and letters from rabbis advising him, you know, mostly that he shouldn't play because he was a role model to these kids. But Greenberg went to the synagogue, on the morning of Rosh Hashanah, and then he went to the ballpark and he played. And the newspapers had asked two leading rabbis in the community their opinion, should Greenberg play or not, and then published those in the afternoon papers. And they showed those to Greenberg in the clubhouse after the game, and it was the first time that Greenberg had seen those opinions. And he said, well, maybe it's... Maybe I was okay not to play, but it still weighs on my conscience, you know, that maybe I let the good Lord down. So, anyway, that's one of the most commonly circulated stories. The other is the story that when he went to the synagogue on Yom Kippur, that people applauded him when he walked in. I spoke with people who were there at the synagogue, and they said that did not happen, but there's an account in the Detroit Jewish Chronicle that on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, when he went back the following morning after hitting the two home runs against the Red Sox on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, that people did applaud him. And so he would tell the story, but I think that was one of the times that his memory let him down, and he equated it with Yom Kippur, but I believed it happened on the second day of Rosh Hashanah.
We're speaking with John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. And Hank Greenberg certainly wasn't the only baseball star, but he was the first, right, to enlist in World War II and go overseas to fight the Nazis.
Well, actually, he was drafted. The United States instituted a draft in the fall of 1940. And Greenberg was drafted, and a pitcher for the Phillies, Hugh Mulcahy, was actually the first to be inducted. But then Greenberg went in May 7th, 1941, and it was a big deal. There were Life magazine gave it 3-page spread of, you know, Hank's induction, and the newsreels, you know, filmed him getting measured for his uniform and all that. And he was, it was a big deal that here was he was the largest player in the game at the time, and so the biggest sports star in America at the time, because he was the reigning American League MVP and the highest paid player in the game. So it was a big deal that here was this baseball star going into the military. And of course, America wasn't in the war yet. It was May 1941. So it was a big deal that baseball was losing one of its stars to the game, or to the military effort. So he goes in, he serves 8 months, Congress changes the law saying that men 30 and over no longer have to serve. So Hank is honorably discharged. He gets out December 5th, 1941, is eager to resume his baseball career. And 2 days later, Pearl Harbor is attacked. And so Greenberg says, we're in trouble. My country needs me. I'm going to reenlist. And he knows full well that in doing so, he'll likely sacrifice the rest of his career. He may never play professional baseball again because he thinks it's going to be a long war. He's already 30 years old. But he's willing to make the sacrifice to serve his country in a time of need. And so this decision of his, and he becomes the first to reenlist. You know, he could have waited until they called him, but he voluntarily went in, became the first Major League Baseball player to reenlist and serve for 4 years. But that decision then for him to reenlist won him the pride and adulation of Americans everywhere.
And he lost 4 years of his career to the military. How did the military change him or influence him both professionally and personally?
I think he grew up a lot. He had lived the life of a privileged baseball player. Not that ball players then earned what they earn today, but it was still a pretty good living to be made. And, you know, he said he would complain if a mattress was too thin in a hotel or, you know, if the accommodations weren't right elsewhere, or if he didn't like his food in a hotel. And he said, being in the military, he really grew up and he got to see the world. He served in the China, Burma, India theater for about 7 months. And so as a result, I think he came back more mature with a different perspective on what was really important. And baseball, before he left, I think was his love. I think when he came back, it was simply an occupation. And he realized there was more to life. He also came back in 1945, mid-season, a much older man, 34. He hadn't played baseball the way that many of the other guys had. You know, Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams, Bob Feller, they were all playing ball during the service or military. I know Feller served on a ship, but he also got a chance to play a lot of baseball. Greenberg played just three exhibition games. And so when he came back, it was tough. After he'd missed three full seasons, parts of two others, and he had served longer than anyone else other than Hugh Mulcahy, 47 months total. So it was a tough grind for him to get back into baseball. But do you want me to tell that story, what it was like when he did?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so he comes back in 1945, mid-season. This is before Musial, Feller, DiMaggio, Williams come back. And so he becomes the test case. People are wondering, can players come back after not serving being away for so long and resume play at their previous level? And the reason this is important, or an important question, is because America is looking to the national pastime to heal from the sacrifices during war. And the game, of course, had suffered without the players, and people want the players, the stars, to return to restore the game to its natural glory to help the team play, or help the country heal. So Greenberg's a test case, and it's tough in his case because he's older, he's 34, he hasn't played for so long. And he comes back on the first day and hits a home run. And it's as though Odysseus has returned and Penelope rejoices. Anyway, he goes through the season. He's hampered by some minor injuries, muscle pulls and such. But on the final day of 1945, he hits that dramatic grand slam home run on the ninth inning to clinch the pennant for the Tigers. And then he goes on to lead them to victory in the World Series. And it becomes not just a victory for Detroit, but for America, to see Greenberg's success, and it gives people hope that things can return to normal and that life can go on.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with John Rosengren, the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. We've talked a lot about his military service. We talked a lot about the anti-Semitism Hank Greenberg faced. After the break, I do want to talk more about his on-the-field accomplishments, including that 1938 season. Tom from Kettering, please hold the line. I'm really interested in speaking with you. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. And today we're talking about Hammer and Hank Greenberg. We're joined by John Rosengren. He's the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Listeners, share your stories about Hank Greenberg. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. And John Rosengren, 1938, one of really the epic baseball seasons by a single player in history, I would say. Walk us through that 1938 season, just how good Greenberg was.
Well, he was on pace to beat Babe Ruth's single-season home run record of 60 home runs, and the newspapers were running these little thermometers, you know, that would fill up as he hit a home run, and they'd run charts showing how and when Babe Ruth had hit his home runs and how Greenberg was doing and, you know, what the projection was. And there was quite a bit of excitement, not just in Detroit, but around the country watching Greenberg. And so a lot of interest in this. It came down to the end of the season, and Greenberg played in Cleveland, and he didn't manage to hit a home run, and he finished with 58. And so he was disappointed by this. So at the same time, you know, 58 home runs in a 154-game season is a pretty good accomplishment in the pre-steroids or performance-enhancing drugs era. Not many guys have done it since. Of course, Roger Maris hit 61 in 61, but it was an incredible display of power and consistency throughout the season. There's talk of whether or not anti-Semitism kept Greenberg from reaching the mark, and he did walk more often in September than he had any other month of the season. You know, as he got close to the record, he got walked more often. I think it's because pitchers were pitching carefully to him, as well as young pitchers being brought up, being wild. And then there were also guys pulling for him. Bill Dickey of the Yankees told him what pitches were coming so Hank could have a better chance to hit home run. An opponent dropped a pop fly so Greenberg would have another at-bat. But at the same time, there was anti-Semitism against him. You know, the same guys who were yelling invectives from the bench were telling him they didn't want, or, you know, didn't want to see him break the record. In a late September game, a pitcher walked by Hank and told him, "You're not going to get any home runs off me, you Jew son of a bitch." So there was anti-Semitism conspiring against him. Whether or not that was what was responsible for keeping him from breaking Babe's record, I think it's impossible to quantify.
And down the list of pressures on Greenberg was his race. I mean, this race for the home run record, it's relatively low, at least on the list of pressures that Greenberg faced. He fell just short. And we do have some sound of Greenberg speaking to NBC later in life. Here he is on how he dealt with that season and how he advised Roger Maris when he was chasing the same record in 1961.
Actually, the pressure, as it's explained in the paper, is the constant asking of questions by reporters as to how do you feel? You think you'll hit one today? You think you'll break the record? How do you hit Joe Blow, who's pitching today? What do you think he'll throw you? Does he curve you much? Do you think they'll pitch to you? All these questions repeated over and over and over again. Hundreds of reporters daily asking basically the same question.
And John Rosengren, he does, you know, this is years later in life, but when he's recounting that story, he does almost sound weary from the media pressure.
Right. And, you know, you can imagine what it's like. If a guy shows up to the ballpark, he's thinking about how am I going to do today, who's pitching, what are they going to throw me? And it's enough to be going through all that in your own mind, but then to have these reporters asking you the same question, having to come up with some sort of answer that seems optimistic. And you're not going to say, well, geez, I really fear this guy, you know, Feller. He might hit me. He's so fast. He's sometimes wild, and I never hit well against him. I'm scared. I'm intimidated. You know, you can't say that sort of stuff. So you're coming up with these responses, and it is a lot of pressure. And then, you know, you have to say it, as he mentioned, they're all asking the same question. So it's not like you have to just tell one guy. You have to tell another guy and another guy and another guy. And it becomes wearying, and then as a constant reminder that it's not just his team who cares how he does, but everybody's watching. Mm-hmm. And so there is additional pressure. I don't think it was as bad with Greenberg as it was with Roger Maris, and certainly not with Hank Aaron when he was going after Babe Ruth's lifetime record of 714. And it's nothing like it is today. However, it was enough to have Greenberg thinking about it and add extra pressure to his pursuit.
Greenberg was a little notoriously thin-skinned with the press as well, right?
He was. I think that was one of his flaws, is that he was not always diplomatic. He was could be thin-skinned. He was took things personally and would nurse a grudge. And he was especially upset with the press for over a couple specific instances. Back when he'd had this conversation with Jack Ziller about whether or not to move to left field, he had confided that conversation with a reporter, thinking it was off the record, and then the reporter printed it, and he was upset about that. Also, in 1941, when he was drafted, there was a controversy. He had written something on his draft questionnaire saying that he'd like to be able to finish the 41 season before going in so he could earn money, because he knew that he had just a limited time to earn money as a ball player, and that got leaked. And so he had reason to be wary of the press, and there are certain reporters he didn't trust. And one time a reporter came up to him and at the Hotel Leland where Greenberg lived in Detroit, and the reporter wanted to shake Greenberg's hand. Greenberg said, "Listen, I don't like you. You don't like me. Let's not pretend otherwise. You go your way. I'll go mine." So it was like that. And unfortunately, later in his career, when he was the general manager of Cleveland, I think the press was what ran him out, you know, cost him his job, because he was not diplomatic with the press, but then their criticisms of him turned public sentiment against him, and eventually the board fired him because the Cleveland Indians couldn't dethrone the Yankee dynasty.
You talked earlier about how his he was not happy with the decision to be moved from first base to the outfield, but he had some other pretty highly publicized battles with ownership and managers.
What are you referring to?
I guess I'm not sure exactly, but that's my understanding, right? That he was notoriously kind of confrontational with managers and ownership.
Well, he got along with Mickey Cochran, who was the manager. He got along with his managers. It was the ownership. When Walter Briggs took over from Frank Nave, and Nave died after the Tigers won the 35 World Series, and Greenberg had won the MVP in 1935, led the Dodgers to Tigers to the pennant. And so Greenberg wanted a raise, and Briggs said, "No, we're not giving you that much." And so the two, right when Briggs took over, the two battled about money. And I think that caused some ill will on both sides and set the stage for 1947, when there was a photo, an article in the Sporting News on January 1st, 1947. Actually, let me back up. In 46, the Tigers, Walter Briggs, the owner, and Hank Greenberg again argued about money, and it had to do with the way that Greenberg had deferred payment of part of his salary for tax purposes, which was a shrewd move on his part, but created a bit of a misunderstanding and then some ill will again on both sides. So Briggs and Greenberg had this testy relationship. In January 1st, 1947, Sporting News runs an article saying Greenberg would like to finish his career in New York with the Yankees, you know, being from the Bronx. And there was a picture that ran with the article, and the article had some misinformation. Dan Daniel didn't get his story quite straight. But anyway, the picture that ran was of Greenberg holding up a Yankee jersey, which made it look like, you know, here he is considering jumping ship and going to the Yankees, abandoning the Tigers. Now, the photograph was from 1943, when Greenberg had played in a war bond game, so it was 3 years old. But there was no note of that in the article. So the public perception was that, yeah, Greenberg was ready to skip out on Detroit. And a couple newspaper guys in Detroit wrote these excoriating articles about Greenberg. And as a result, Briggs had the excuse to dump him. And so he waved him out of the league, and Greenberg wound up with the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1947. But he was very bitter about the way that Briggs just dumped him.
Mm-hmm. You also write that Greenberg would arrive to the ballpark hours before his teammates. He would show up to groove his swing or improve his footwork around first base. But he also discovered that he could use bicycle tape to extend the webbing of his first baseman's mitt. He would use licorice to resin his pockets. Was he viewed as a dirty player at all?
I don't think so. I think those were the tricks of the time that people used. I mean, this is spitballs had only recently been deemed illegal. And so players did whatever they could to get an advantage, and that was considered part of the game. Now, opponents did complain about the extra webbing he put on his glove, and eventually Major League Baseball ruled that illegal, though the glove manufacturers quickly caught on and improved the gloves to the point where there was additional webbing. So it made it easier for first basemen to scoop up balls. But he was a guy who was very competitive by nature and just looking to get whatever edge he could to win a ball game.
I know that the anti-Semitism factored into this, but aside from that, was he well liked? He was he was a good looking guy. I think it's fair to call him a socialite, at least in some context. He was a snappy dresser. Did other players seem to like him for the most part?
You know, I think he was charming too. He sometimes could be aloof among teammates, but he also could be very personable and fun when he would relax. And I think he got even more so later in life when the pressures of the ballpark were gone. Like his tennis buddies all kind of loved him universally. But he also was a guy who had been treated poorly by veterans when he came up. And so he decided he was going to treat the rookies well, and he took guys like Bertie Tebbets or Rudy York under his wing, bought them suits, taught them how to dress, taught them how to eat with a knife and fork in a restaurant, and so showed them the way. And Harry Eisenstadt, who was a fellow Jew, and Greenberg helped tutor and took, again, he was a mentor to these guys and a mensch. And so he was well-liked by a lot of his teammates. He was resented by some, especially as he got older and he became the highest-paid ball player in the game, and he eventually made $100,000 with the Pirates. Some people resented him for they believed he didn't earn his salary. Now, he'd earned it years previously and was just finally getting his due, but they thought he wasn't worth it that day. And so there were people who didn't like him for that reason.
And he did spend his final days, as you say, playing tennis at a country club in California.
Yeah, the Beverly Hills Tennis Club, where he'd play with guys like Jimmy Connors or Bobby Riggs. And then Walter Matthau tells the story of growing up as a kid in Brooklyn. He admired Greenberg, and Greenberg was his hero. And so Matthau didn't play tennis, but he joined the Beverly Hills Tennis Club simply so he could have the chance to meet Greenberg. And it's a very small club, so he did meet Greenberg, and they became pals.
6'4", I'm sure he would be a very good tennis player. After finishing this book, what was your lasting impression of Greenberg? What did you learn in this process, I guess?
Well, I learned a tremendous amount about the pressures he faced as a Jew in America during a time of intense anti-Semitism. I also realized, I think we look to our heroes sometimes. We want them to be perfect, and Greenberg was not. He failed, and failed repeatedly, both as a ball player and as a person. And that was hard for me because I came to love Greenberg and was rooting for him to do well. And so when he didn't do well, especially in a personal situation, I was saddened by that. But at the same time, I think because he was human, it makes and he had these failings, it makes the things he did well stand out even more and seem more impressive. And so the way he was compassionate to others who had been abused, like Jackie Robinson in his final year, Greenberg was one of the rare opponents to give Jackie Robinson support. I mean, I think that was a tremendous thing. He stood up for Curt Flood at a time when mm-hmm. Flood was challenging the reserve clause and organized baseball, and very few others would do that. These, I think, were heroic acts when he stood tall as a Jew and didn't shirk his identity. It was something to be proud of, not just, I'm not Jewish, so certainly the fellow Jews could be proud of him, but I think fellow human beings could be proud of who he was and how he stood tall.
Well, it was a great book, a great read, and as a baseball fan, I'm really pleased to learn that Bob Feller was the only pitcher who genuinely frightened Greenberg as a Cleveland fan. That was good to hear. And But John Rosengren is the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. Thanks again for your time this morning, John.
Well, you're welcome, Steve. Thanks for your interest.
And this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, and you're listening here on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at wosu.org/allsides.